Hello, I'm Richard Kagoya, and here's what's coming up on Focus on Africa. Can rising Amhara-Tigray tensions plunge Ethiopia into wider conflict?
There is a potential for the conflict to expand along the border between Amhara and Tigray region, but I don't see any triggering effect of ethnic conflicts in other regions.
And debunking claims about malaria vaccines by a popular Nigerian preacher that are having adverse effects.
We found some voice messages on WhatsApp groups. And then we, you know, found people warning about, you know, there's this vaccine that's coming to schools that they're going to give to your children. Be careful, don't take it.
Plus, what would it take for Egypt to clinch the coveted rights to host the 2036 Olympic Games?
Egypt now needs to expand its reach beyond the African continent and negotiate with countries outside Africa. The winner of the bid will be decided via a process of negotiation and dialogue.
It's Friday, the 19th of April. First, we begin in Ethiopia. If you listened to a previous episode, you'll have heard of efforts to mobilize funds to tackle a humanitarian crisis that is affecting an estimated 15 million people there. Today, we highlight another crisis unfolding in the northern part of the country, pitting Tigrayan and Amharan forces. Tensions are simmering following recent clashes over a disputed territory in southern Tigray along the border with Amhara. Amhara ethnic militia called Fano annexed the region at the height of the civil war 3 years ago. Recent clashes are the most violent to be witnessed since the signing of the peace deal that ended one of the continent's deadliest conflict in years. Could the fighting jeopardize the 2022 peace agreement between the federal government and Tigray People's Liberation Front? I called up Dr. Bizune Yimenu, teaching fellow at the University of Birmingham. I started by asking him what triggered the latest wave of clashes.
The recent clash is obviously initiated because of the disagreement between Amhara and Tigray region regarding the contentious territories between the two regions. Following the civil war between the federal government and the Tigray region, the Amhara regional administration controlled several territories that they claim to belong to them. But now the Pretoria Agreement says that everything should go back to pre-civil war status quo. So I think the TPLF or the regional administration of Tigray want to recontrol those areas where Amhara region has been controlling since the start of Tigray war.
If I'm just looking at the statistics here, I can see that, Amhara is the second largest ethnic population in the country at about 25 million people. Just how important is the disputed territory to Amhara?
The land is obviously very fertile, so both regions want to control. But beyond the economic importance of the land, there is also the issue of identity, because some of the population living in those areas assert that their identity is not Tigrayan, so they want to be administered under Amhara region. However, the claim by Amhara Fano and the nationalist Amharas does not stop in Tigray, because they also claim territories from other regions, including Oromia and Benishangul Gumuz. So Ethiopia has experience of solving such contentious areas through referendum, and it's possible to solve these issues through peaceful means, as the constitution stipulates.
And maybe just for the sake of those people who are not familiar with how Ethiopia is basically administered. So you've got the federal government, then you've got the regional governments here. In this case, so we're referring to Amhara. And we know that Amhara had really rallied behind Prime Minister Abiy's government during the civil war. But it seems like right now we're seeing the ethnic militia group, the Fano, and the federal government also clashing. What's the position of Addis Ababa on this issue? What's the stand of Prime Minister Abiy's government?
Yeah, Ethiopia is a federal country, and there is, as you mentioned, federal government, and there are about 12 regions that have their own government. And most of the regions are based around major ethnic groups. So like Tigray is dominated by Tigrayans, Amhara by Amhara people, the same regarding Oromia or Somali. So there is always contention over territories. But when it comes to this specific clash, because the National Defense Force also want to return the Tigrayans displaced from those areas during the Tigray War, And there is also Amhara administration established in those areas after following Tigray war. There is a potential that the National Defense Force is also supporting the returning the displaced people to those areas controlled by Amhara regional administration since the Tigray war has started. So considering the Pretoria Agreement, I think this is part of the deal. So returning the displaced people to their original location and reinstating the administration of those areas to their original administrator, which is the Tigray region. So in this case, the federal government obviously support this initiative because it is part of the deal.
When you're talking about these disputes being resolved possibly through a constitutional referendum, I know that will take a bit of time and there are pressing issues that need to be attended to at this moment. What's a realistic solution to this problem?
The solution is that, so when I say a referendum, it is not about changing the constitution, because the constitution clearly states that when there is disagreement between two regions regarding the administration of a given area, or when a given population in a given area want to join another region rather than its previous region, there is a clear constitutional procedure, and those specific districts would be allowed to choose where they want to be administered. And Ethiopia has this experience. Previously, there was disagreement between Somali and Oromia region, for example, and some districts wanted to be governed under Somali, and then they decided through referendum, and some of them wanted to be governed under Oromia, and that happened. And the same happened between Oromia and Southern Nations. So it is not about reforming or changing the constitution, but it is only about implementing the constitution and letting the people who live in those districts to decide where they want to be governed, rather than imposing, you know, a given administrative structure using force and violence.
And just looking at the clashes and this dispute, it's really a cause for concern. And just wondering about the implications, is there a chance that this might affect the agreement signed in Pretoria between the TPLF and the federal government?
Obviously, yeah, the Tigray region have been relatively stable since the peace deal was signed. Amhara region were already in chaos, especially because of the conflict between FANO and the federal government. But this clash spoils the relatively stable Tigray. But I don't think it affects the implementation of the deal, Pretoria Agreement, because removing National Defense Force and foreign forces, including Eritrea, from Tigray was part of the Pretoria Agreement. And I think the initiative of returning the displaced people to their location and bringing back the administration of those areas under Tigray regional administration is part of the deal. And it is like implementing the deal rather than acting as an obstacle.
Considering that there are simmering tensions, you know, ethnic tensions in Ethiopia, there could be pockets of that in different parts of the country. So do you think this flare-ups could trigger others elsewhere?
I don't anticipate this clash would have a triggering effect to other ethnic conflicts in other regions. But clashes between Tigray and Amhara region may expand to, for example, the Western Tigray, which is also contested between the two regions and currently occupied by Amhara regional forces. So there is a potential for the conflict to expand along the border between Amhara and Tigray region, but I don't see any triggering effect of ethnic conflicts in other regions, because the issue is between the two regions specifically.
And for Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, I know that his plate is full. He's dealing with so many other challenges. How does he keep control of this latest development plus others that he's facing?
Yeah, especially considering there has been conflict between the federal government and the FANO militias in Amhara region. This conflict would have serious consequences on the side of the support Amhara might give to Abiy Ahmed administration, because some of the people are already supporting the FANO. But when this is added, there might be a potential for FANO to garner more support from ethnic Amharas. But the government of Ethiopia should, I think, address similar issues throughout the country through peaceful negotiation. And for example, some of the negotiations started between the OLA, two rounds of talk in Tanzania, didn't bring any success. But those initiatives should continue. And the major problem on both sides I see is both of them present, non-starter demanders, unrealistic demanders. And I think they need to do some compromise in order to reach agreement and solve issues peacefully. In between, it is the mass, the public, and millions of population have been displaced. And there are other factors, economic unemployment and other issues are also challenging the country. So finding peaceful way of solving such issues through negotiation should be prioritized.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bizune Ihimeno, for speaking to us on Focus on Africa. We appreciate your expertise on this matter. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Pastor Chris Oyakhilome, founder of the Christ Embassy Church in Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos, is one of Africa's known evangelical preachers. Usually dressed in his signature close-neck suit, he is viewed each week by his hundreds of thousands of followers around the world. The BBC has, however, reviewed dozens of his sermons between 2023 and 2024 and found that he has been spreading anti-vaccine messages to his followers. Specifically, he's been targeting the new malaria vaccine as it is being distributed in African countries. Now, malaria is a deadly disease. The majority of malaria cases and deaths globally occur in Africa. Medical experts are concerned the pastor's far-reaching sermons might negatively affect vaccine take-up in Africa. Ronke Alo is with the BBC Global Disinformation Team that carried out the investigation.
Our global disinformation team, you know, started reviewing dozens of Pastor Chris's sermon from 2023 and thereabouts, I think about August to September, because we found some claims about malaria vaccine and why it should be dead on arrival on social media. So we traced the origin of some of these tweets and we found that it was coming from some of Pastor Chris's church members. So we began to review, you know, some of the sermons within 2023 and 2024. That's in the last 6 months thereabouts. And we found that he has been, you know, spreading anti-vaccine messages to his followers. And he is specifically targeting the new malaria vaccine that's been distributed by the WHO, you know, across a number of African countries. For example, he has said in one of his sermons that was published in August that malaria vaccine was never a problem to people in Africa. And we found this to be false because from the data we got from the WHO, malaria vaccine is a huge problem. From this data, we found that about 90% of malaria-related deaths happened in the continents in 2022. And according to it, we have, you know, like children under five accounting for around 80% of this debt. So Pastor Gray said the malaria vaccine program, you know, which he allegedly also claimed was sponsored by, you know, the Bill Gates. You know, Bill Gates is always at the center of a lot of conspiracy theories. So he said the plan is to depopulate the continent. So these were the claims we saw about this vaccine that was concerning for us. And when we found those claims, we also reached out to his company and the church, you know, for comment, but we didn't get a reply.
So why is everybody concerned with those claims?
And so after we found, you know, those claims on his social media platform, on his streaming service platforms, we reached out to, you know, medical experts to find out if this, you know, will have an implication. And one line that did cut across every of the interviews we had was how harmful his message could be. And it's because of his influence. When we, you know, approached, you know, the WHO, which is like the agency to, you know, give us recommendations regarding how impactful his messages could be, they told us that influential figures like Oyakhilome can contribute to how locals, you know, spread myths and misconceptions that could potentially fuel vaccine hesitancy.
And what's been really the impact of this?
Of course, we cannot establish a direct link of the impacts. We don't have the data, but we know that we found some voice messages on WhatsApp groups. I think it's a school WhatsApp group that some have forwarded to us since we began this investigation. And then we, you know, found people warning about, you know, there's this vaccine that's coming to schools that they're going to give to your children. Be careful. Don't take it. The plan is to depopulate. And after the, you know, the WHO also announced the distribution of the malaria vaccine, then, and it was published by local newspapers in Nigeria, the comment section actually did give out how people were receiving this distribution announcements. So the comment section, we had people saying, they've started again. Don't come to Africa. There's a plan to depopulate. And this, we can directly link some of this to Pastor Chris Oyakhilome, but one thing is constant. They were also talking about depopulation, which was part of what he did broadcasted in his messages.
And Ronke, I'm just curious to know who Pastor Chris Oyakhilome is and what kind of influence he commands, not only in Nigeria, but across Africa.
Pastor Chris, who would also call him, is a televangelist. He's been, there for quite some decades. He's a very influential pastor in Nigeria. He commands, quite a number of people. And when we're talking about number of people, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of congregation. I was in his church, after we battled our investigation, we wanted to, get the ambience from his church. So I was there in his headquarters in Lagos, and they had this, pastor's conference where quite a number of them, the auditorium was filled to the brim. We had tens of thousands of people coming from around the world with flags from different countries. And these are pastors and partners of the church. Having conversation with one of the pastors, he talked about his influence. He's from Zimbabwe. Yeah, he talked about the influence, how he's been, received. So that was just us trying to get the ambience of his church. Pastor Chris has his own messaging app. And when you go on Play Store, he has over 1 million downloads. He has a streaming service. He has his cable TV. He has churches everywhere around the world.
Do you think the claims could impact uptake of malaria vaccine in any way in Nigeria and, his followers around the world?
We can't establish that, right, because we also, we do not have the data. But from what our medical experts have told us, religious leaders did have, a command on it. And another thing I we could also say is we also spoke to some of his church members. One of them did tell us that she's not a believer in the malaria vaccine or whatever vaccine there is. And I asked why. He said, this is a plan to depopulate. And she specifically told me that I'm not even going to let anyone around me, get this vaccine. And in one of WHO, one of their infodemic group, I think IRA right now, they also, did put out how Pastor Chris was on the watch list. So what IRA does, the Africa Infodemic Response Center, where, they monitor reactions to vaccines, they also did warn about how some of the messages of Pastor Chris could affect the vaccination drive.
And speaking that he's been on the watch list and the infodemic, has he ever made similar claims in the past, say, for instance, at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Pastor Chris is no stranger to anti-vaccine disinformation. Recently, he has also, targeted the human papillomavirus, that's the HPV vaccine, which is meant to protect women against cervical cancer. He said specifically about the HPV vaccine that they have something else up their sleeves. It's not about cancer. He has also made claims about RNA vaccine, that it alters the DNA. He did also make claims about the COVID pandemic, the coronavirus, and also vaccines, which also resulted in him getting a fine from Ofcom. That's the British media regulation platform. They also said he was spreading misleading and potentially harmful statements about the pandemic and the vaccines.
And finally, have Nigerian authorities said anything in response to these claims?
We've not seen anything yet.
All right, Ronke, thank you for your time.
All right, thank you for having me.
Ronke Alo from the BBC Global Disinformation Team. As mentioned, the BBC Global Disinformation Team did reach out to Pastor Chris Oyakhilome's ministry for response, but they got none. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. I'm Richard Kagoy. The countdown to this year's Olympic Games has begun in earnest. Wednesday this week marked 100 days to go to the Paris Games, in what's been a significant week for African athletes taking part in the Games. But just how far away is Africa from hosting the Olympics? Well, South Africa put up a show when it hosted one of the biggest sporting events, the 2010 FIFA World Cup. However, bids by some African countries have not been successful. Now, Egypt is eyeing the coveted rights to host the Games in 2036. The BBC's Aisling Vidan has been following the story closely and joined us from Johannesburg. I started by asking him, what are the prospects of an African country winning the bid?
They can be very excited. From our dialogue with the Egyptian National Organizing Committee, they are very serious about a bid for the 2036 Olympic Games. And they've been developing facilities in the new administrative capital in Cairo, which will be capable of hosting Olympic sports. However, at the same time, Egypt is likely to face very strong bids from the likes of Indonesia, Turkey, and India. And there could potentially also be bids from the likes of South Korea, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia. However, we can safely say that Africa is now serious to bid for the Olympic Games.
Indeed, as you say, it could be Africa's time. But one of the questions that people ask whenever an African bid comes into stage, a big sports event, is whether we do still have the capacity to host that. Is that a valid concern?
A lot of people will agree that it is a valid concern. However, we can now say with confidence that there are three countries in Africa which have the potential to stage major international events to a world-class standard. And those three countries are Egypt, South Africa, and Morocco. Senegal is also showing potential as a future host of international major events, and they are set to host the Youth Games in 2026. Africa is continuously improving its ability to host these events.
So if we look at the potential, Egypt's bid for the 2036 Games, what does the country need to prove so that it can host the Games?
The country has already taken steps to show its potential. And in 2022, it invited the International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach. From what we've been told, Bach was very impressed with what he had seen. And also, from what we heard, Egypt has the full support of the African continent in its bid to host the Games. What it needs to do now is reach out to countries outside the African continent in order to improve its bid. Because at the end of the day, the winner of the bid will be decided via a process of negotiation and dialogue. For Egypt to significantly improve its chances, it now needs to expand its reach beyond the African continent and negotiate with countries outside Africa to support it.
Yeah, let's just do some bit of reflection here. But, you know, bidding to host an Olympic Games is not new for African countries. If we can take you back in time, South Africa put together a bid in 2004. Yeah, and Dr. Camilla Sot-Aris, an expert in sport, tourism and events management, worked on that bid. And so she told the BBC that a big part of why that bid failed was due to geopolitics.
South Africa had just come out to re-emerge from apartheid, has not had a track record at the time with Olympic sports in particular. And I think it's very important to underscore that having a track record of hosting major events is something that is particularly important with hosting a Games, because with that comes the building of infrastructure, but also building capacity and soft infrastructure to host. So I think at the time, it was also in relation to the bidding process that was not in South Africa's favor at the time. And that has changed now.
Ashley, you've spoken to Dr. Camilla at length in the last few weeks. Do you think changes to the bidding process itself have made it a little easier for African countries to concede an Olympic bid?
Yes, and actually going back to African countries bidding for the Olympics, it's not new at all. And the first African bid actually dates back to more than 100 years ago. Egypt first bid for the Olympic Games in 1916 via Alexandria, and it ended up losing the bid to Berlin. And in 1936, it also bidded and lost to Berlin as well. The 1916 Games were cancelled. South Africa came very close in 2004 before ultimately losing to Athens in the penultimate round. And now it's safe to say that Africa would stand a much better chance if it bidded again. In 2004, Africa had hosted very few major international events. However, at this point in time, it's now hosted several with success. And because of this reason, it now has a track record, and people are much more likely to trust African bids for major international sporting events.
Ashlyn, we saw with Qatar World Cup that certain issues, particularly around human rights, can create a great deal of opposition in the choice of a host. Could that be a factor in any African bid?
According to many people, this should always be a factor. However, at the same time, we should always realize that we can focus on hosting sporting events and human rights issues at the same time. Sporting events can also help contribute positively towards making better change to human rights issues within the country. We've seen this with the case of Saudi Arabia. Since Saudi started hosting major international events, it has slowly started putting in place implements to improve the rights of women within the country. The same can be applied to any other country in the world and also to African countries. And hosting major sporting events can also bring attention to humanitarian and human rights issues within a country that may have not otherwise received attention if it did not host those major international events.
On the flip side, how could hosting the games benefit a nation?
Hosting international events can also create better infrastructure for a country which can benefit it in the long term. South Africa did make many mistakes when it hosted the 2010 Football World Cup, but at the same time, it also got certain things right. For example, the Gautrain train system, which was built in Johannesburg, has been a major success. Because of the Gautrain, many people in Johannesburg can use it on a daily basis and they save on fuel costs. In addition to that, there have also been beneficial transport systems in the major cities of South Africa, which were built as a result of the World Cup. So when Egypt plans to launch its bid, it's very important that it does consult South Africa in order to avoid making the same mistakes that South Africa made in the past. Hosting these events for all nations will always be a process of unlearning, relearning, and learning. Whenever a nation hosts an event, it should analyze previous host nations and aim to learn from their mistakes while improving the eventual output to create a better, sustainable, and environmentally friendly event.
Okay, Ashlyn, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Ashlyn Verdun in Johannesburg. Thanks for listening. This episode of Focus on Africa was produced by Yvette Twakira Maria and Bella Hassan in London. Paul Bachibinga was in charge, and the technical producer was Danny Cox. Our editors are Alice Modengi and Andre Lombard. Also check out our sister podcast, Africa Daily. It's a deep dive into one news story shaping the continent. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Kagoe. We'll talk again next time.